Good afternoon. My name is Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the committee and Dan for asking me to share. I think I do. And it certainly makes me very comfortable to be sitting up here with the Last Supper group. My story. I come from an alcoholic family. My father was alcoholic. Several of my uncles were alcoholic. Holidays at the house were pretty much like gunfight at OK Corral. And I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I am CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic. And the Catholic part plays a big role in my life. I really hate to talk about my childhood, but it is so difficult to overlook 35 years of my life. So I kind of have to go through the whole thing. My father and mother decided to divorce when I was about 2 or 3 years old. And at that time, there were only two children, my older brother and myself. And my grandparents took my older brother, and they put me up for adoption. And his sister here in California said, ship him out here, we'll keep him. And so I was put on a Trailways bus with one of those traveler's aides, and I came out to California. And I don't remember the part, but my mother tells me I made quite a scene at the bus terminal, that I would be a good boy if they didn't send me away. So I got here to California, and my mother and father decided to get back together, and it was back to New York. So before I was 5 years old, I lost 2 families. And that also had a big impact in my life because I was at that age where they were supposed to love me. I was supposed to be cute. And I was taken away from both families. So my father's drinking kept going. And he came up with a theory and a philosophy that he pursued to help stop his drinking. He thought if he had more kids, he would stop drinking. I am here to tell you the opposite is the way it works. And his drinking really took off. And he left us, I was 15, and he took off for parts unknown. My mother had to raise the 6 of us. I had to go to work. And I also made the decision that I would not be an alcoholic. That was firm. I knew exactly what alcoholics were. It was the only decision I've ever made in my life where I was completely aware of what it was all about. At the age of 18, my father showed up in the picture again, and his sister paid for all of us to move to Seattle, Washington, and start life anew. And so the gang, I was a street gang person in Brooklyn, gave me a going-away party. And since I was 18, I could drink. So I had my first drink. The money they gave me as a gift, I gave back to them to go out and get more booze. I had found the nectar of the gods, and my whole life changed, my whole attitude. I now was really part of the gang, and I was leaving it. And I got to Seattle. They changed the rules on me. You had to be 21. And I was working at Boeing, building the KC-135, which is a military transport plane. And that plays a part in my story later on. So from my 18th birthday, 10 months later, I was living on Skid Row in San Francisco. I have no idea what social drinking is about. I love blackout drinking, and that's where I wound up on the Embarcadero. Now, you know, he says, well, what's wrong with that? Well, in 1950, it wasn't built up. It was just nothing but old railroad tracks and the docks and what have you. And I was sleeping in a wooden box on the Embarcadero. Now, I didn't have a problem with alcohol because I was collecting material for a book that I was going to write on real people. And you know how many real people are down on Skid Row. But anyway, I thought I wasn't quite 19, and I love Skid Row. The thing that's really wonderful about Skid Row is your social life is held to a minimum. You don't have obligations, and that's what I like, because I don't like people. My people have never done anything for me. The world is rotten, and that was my attitude, and that helped me stay drunk. But I did think I was a little too young. Back in those days, there weren't young people on the streets like there are today, and I joined the Army. And I wound up in France. Now, you know, alcoholics have a strange way of thinking. As a matter of fact, that's what alcoholism is, our strange way of thinking. We like to tell the stories of drinking and the peccadilloes we get into because they're humorous and they're pathetic, but the real problem of alcoholism is how we think. And I thought that if I didn't mix my beer and my hard liquor, I wouldn't be an alcoholic. And if I didn't drink wine, I wouldn't be an alcoholic. And if I didn't drink before noon, I wouldn't be an alcoholic. And one by one, those rationalizations fell by the wayside. And it was pretty much a thing of, oh, that's okay, I'll drink in the morning, but I still have two more defenses against being an alcoholic. And then finally, I was an alcoholic. And I started drinking wine in France. One of the things, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, it's very insular. But here I was in France, and one time I was down in Paris, drunk out of my mind, and I fell down a sewer. And as I was climbing up, I could see the Eiffel Tower. And so when I got back to the barracks, I wrote home to tell everybody how I had been sightseeing in Paris for the weekend. And about that time, my father joined AA, and the literature started to come. And, you know, they talk about resentments are the bane of alcoholics, but I had a legitimate resentment. This was real now. This is no bullshit. His drinking ruined my life. His AA ruined my drinking. There was no common ground. I could not learn to like that man. I got out of the Army and decided to go to California because I had, that's where they finally moved, the whole family. And I developed the idea that the world owed me a living and I'm not supposed to work. But my father is going to have to pay because I supported his kids while he was drinking. And in order to help him pay, I would take him to his meetings. And I was going to keep him sober because he needed to get this income. And at the meetings, they would talk about me. Not once did somebody stand up point to him and say, "You bastard, you ruined that kid's life." But I kept identifying with him until one night I said, "No, we're not going to that meeting, we're going to this meeting," because I knew he called ahead. And lo and behold, I identified again. And so I stood up at the ripe old age of 22 and identified myself as an alcoholic in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had some secrets that I didn't know about. And so for the next 6 years, I was in and out of AA like a yo-yo. When I drink, I go right to the skids. I cannot tell you how I like Skid Row. And I started riding freight trains. And one of the things about freight trains, you know, they talk about incomprehensible demoralization. And I was on the top of a freight train, and we were going through tunnels, and so I had to hold on to that catwalk. And as I'm ducking from the top of the tunnels, the roof, they hang these steel balls on bars. And what those are to do is to knock the trash off the train. And as that was all hitting me, I thought, you know, how did I wind up doing this? And it wasn't enough to stop me. I joined the service one more time. And on that drunk, I wound up in the Philippines. I went to the meetings while I was in the Philippines. I got sober once more. I stayed in touch with New York. I was a loner type. Sometimes there was two of us for the meetings. Sometimes it was just enormous. There was six. But I stayed sober there. And I got a transfer to England, and I stopped in New York to say thank you to the people there. And the woman who I was in correspondence with said, "Just a minute, please. I want you to meet somebody." She went in, and this gentleman comes in, and he says, "Hi, my name is Bill." And I say, "Hi, my name is Jerry." And I'm in uniform, and I'm thinking how lucky he is to meet this loner from the Philippines, and that was my introduction to Bill Wilson. And I went to England, stayed sober, but all of a sudden I had these very strange feelings that I was beginning to acknowledge about the other guys in the barracks and in the squadron with me. And as it turns out, this young guy came in. By then, I had lost my clearance. I forgot. I didn't tell you. I was a cryptographer, and I had top-secret clearance. But once they discovered my alcoholism, they asked me, "Maybe you would like to work someplace else." Going around drunk as I am with all the secrets I had, they didn't think it was the best idea. So I had become the secretary for the colonel, and this kid came in the squadron, and I maneuvered him into my room. It was two-men room, and I was just going crazy. And eventually I stressed myself out, and I wound up in the hospital, and they decided I needed to be discharged because my condition was terrible. And on the process of going out, I had to meet the psychiatrist, and he said to me, "Do you want to tell me what your problem is?" And at that moment, I understood what my secret was—that I was gay. And I said, "No, I don't want to tell you." And his response was, "Well, I'm here to help you." And my response was, "I don't pay your salary. The government does. I don't want to tell you." So he signed my medical discharge from the Air Force. I I got discharged with a mental and a physical medical discharge type thing. I came back to the States, moved in with my parents again because they were going to have to support me. I'm sitting there having dinner with them, and it dawns on me they hate me. I get up from the table, and I leave, and I wound up in Venice sleeping under the pier. I could not stand the idea that I was going to tell them I was gay. I could not stand the idea that I was gay. I just couldn't deal with it whatsoever. And I drank a hole in my stomach down in Venice. So I couldn't drink and I couldn't eat. And I decided, okay, I'm going to San Francisco. My life pretty much up to that point was something like the pinball machine, where that ball just keeps hitting the side and keeps hitting the electrons and bouncing all around. And I got to San Francisco, and I started to go to meetings again. And this time I was befriended by some very friendly guys who were going to meetings. And this was 1967. And all of a sudden, they decided that they were going to start a specialized meeting, and they asked me if I would like to come because they were going to have the first gay meeting in San Francisco. And I was offended. Why would they ask me to go to a gay meeting? Now, the fact that I was working on Market Street during the nights, but I wasn't gay because I was getting paid. But anyway, I thought, well, anything I can do to help them, I'll do it. So I went to the gay meetings, and for the very first time in my life, at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt at home. I felt like I was among people who knew me, even though they didn't, and who I knew them. And it was really remarkable. And so I went to meetings with them for a while. We only had the one meeting a week, the one gay meeting a week. And I needed to go out and experiment one more time. And I did, and that was in January 1968. I was, I think I was 28 then. And that was my last drink. In January 1968. And again, now I'd like to talk about alcoholism, because I thought, I need to be a movie star. I don't want to work. And so I packed my 1952 Chevrolet, and I drove from San Francisco to L.A., and I went to Schwab's drugstore because Lana Turner got discovered there. And I had a pair of tight white jeans, and they were just as good as her Angora sweater. And I got to sleep with all the wrong people at the right time. And my movie career went nowhere. So I resorted to what I know. I made my living off the streets of Hollywood. And at that time, too, in The Advocate, a little blurb came out and said, if you're a friend of Bill W.'s, call this number. And so I called the number, and six of us showed up, and we had a meeting at Troy Perry's Addict. And that was the first gay meeting in Los Angeles. And we went and talked to Central Office and said, we're starting gay meetings, and so we want to be listed in the book with a G. And they said, no, you're not, that we don't have specialized meetings. In the book, there's this meeting with a W for women only, and there's another one for men's stag, and you don't have specialized meetings. And they said, that's right. So the six of us got together again, and we started something called Alcoholics Together, which was the beginning of gay AA in Los Angeles. And as it grew, we started the AT Center, and we also put together something called the Van Ness House. Now, my participation in those events was more as somebody sobering up. I was still living off the streets. I was still running wild. And that whole episode of my life went on for 3.5 years. You know, at this point, I really need to put to rest one of the rumors about AT. We did not try to change the format. We did not say it was going to be what it was like, who was there, and what were they wearing. However, that gets out and about, and it doesn't need to be there. So, at that point in my life, I was living, I don't know if you know L.A., but the area of Western and Santa Monica Boulevard. That's where I was living. It's not the high-end area. And I got involved in a shooting. My roommate got shot. He was selling heroin. So that tells you the kind of people I was hanging with. But I wasn't drinking. I was just part of the guys. And the police came and took me away. And I wound up in a jail cell with handcuffs on. And I'm thinking, there is not a lot of AA people in here. And when all else fails, read the directions. And when I got out of that mess, I went home, I got a sponsor, and I took the steps the way they were laid out. I did not concern myself with if the Menninger brothers were there to help me write my fourth step, and I didn't care if the Pope was available for the fifth step. But I went through the steps, and I did take the fourth step, and I wrote it out extensively. And it's a fearless moral inventory. And instead of finding out all the people who hurt me and all the people who made my life miserable and all the people who made me a victim, I looked at my part in all the episodes in my life, and it turns out just about 99.9% of the troubles that I have were instigated by me in some way or another. And also I found out in my fifth step, which was probably the most devastating indictment I could find out about me, and that doesn't talk about the thievery and the prostitution and all the other. But what it was that I am an opportunist. I have absolutely no values, absolutely no bedrock of cross this line, and that means I'm terrible. I will just take advantage of anybody at any time, and that's how I got by in life. And I really thought, Jesus, Jerry, you are a piece of shit. And working the program from that point on, I was really able to build a different life. I had to go out and get a real job. So that was kind of unnerving to do something like that. And I got a job in an insurance company in Santa Monica, and they sent me to IBM Word Processing School. Now, I'm a high school dropout from Brooklyn, and to go to IBM school, I've got it made. This is it, my certificate. I am there. A couple of months later, they fired the whole department, and I heard myself say, that's okay, because somebody's looking for me and they can't find me if I'm here. Now, I never meet a positive experience with a positive attitude, much less a negative experience with a positive attitude. It just doesn't happen. So where that came from, I have no idea, other than my involvement in wanting to be sober and to live a sober life and to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. What was happening to me was a change of attitude that I really didn't understand. And I'd like to talk about the steps a little bit. When we take the first step, that we're powerless over alcohol, there was no doubt in my mind about that. I'm a blackout drinker and I love it. But the unmanageability part, I don't understand that, because everything was somebody else's fault. So I was only reacting. I was never an instigator. When I took that step after the jail experience, I understood that my life is unmanageable because I make bad decisions to anything that happens to me. If there's a positive way to answer something, I will take the negative. And that's the unmanageability part, because it's so instinctual. And then I turn to the second step, to be restored to sanity. That's scary. I really thought I was going to become a poster boy for mental health. But what I found out was that I was now living my life one day at a time without taking a drink, and I'm not able to do that. So that meant that I was looking at life and not answering it with a drink. That's sanity. That's living your life, having something terrible happen to you, having something successful happen to you, and not take a drink behind it. That was new, and that was sanity. And turn my will and my life over to care of God as I understand him. Whoever put that "as I understand him" in the book needs to be bronzed and made a saint. My Catholicism really played a part in devastating me. And to think that I had to turn to God for sobriety, I couldn't do it. But as that "as I understand him" part came in, I was able to create a God of my understanding. Now, as the years have gone on, I've tried to go back to Catholicism. I've tried to go back to a couple of other religions. And what I've had to do finally was to divorce myself from religion, and to divorce the word God from religion, and understand that I use a power greater than myself, or a higher power, so that I can understand it, that I don't think there is a punishing God for me. I don't think that there's a God who punishes me because I'm gay. I don't think that there's a God out there saying, you've had it good long enough, now it's time to pull the rug. I don't think I get a parking space because there is a God who thinks I ought to have a parking space. I do get the parking spaces because I've lived a good life. And so those are the turmoils and the problems that I had facing the steps. As I point out, the principles of AA were never written with me in mind, because they're all against everything I stand for. I'm lazy. I think everybody should do it for me. And I recall one time in that period where I was sober but not working a program, and I was telling people that I had bills to pay, and somebody made the suggestion, why don't you get a job? And I thought, what's that all about? You know, I have bills. You're supposed to do something for me. I found out it didn't work that way. So moved on, and now I would like to share. It wasn't until I was about 17 years sober where I really came into my own, where I really grew up. I understand that getting old is mandatory. Growing up is optional. And that's what happened to me eventually. I had to grow up. And I as I said, I was about 17 years sober. And then I understood the impact of what alcoholism is. That just because I had stopped drinking, it didn't mean that I was cured. It didn't mean that my problems were behind me. What it meant was that I now had to really live with the fact that I am an alcoholic, that I have a reprieve from alcoholism one day at a time. I have to manage it that way. I cannot manage my alcoholism a lifetime at a time. I am living proof that you can attain long-term sobriety if you don't die and keep going to meetings. But at some point, I had to really understand what my disease was all about. And my disease is still working and very active within me. And from time to time, it will express itself another way. I used to think that when I went into compulsive sex or when I went into compulsive eating or when I went into compulsive gambling, I wasn't doing something right. That's the way the Catholics had taught me, that if you're wrong, you're not doing something right. But what it is that the disease will always try to express itself within me, and I will act out if I'm not vigilant. And sometimes I kind of like it acting out, and I take it up to the brink where the pain begins to be so detrimental that I need the medicine to stop it. And that's when I have to get back to the fundamentals. That's when I have to go back to the meetings daily. That's when I have to work with a newcomer. That's when I have to talk to somebody about what I really am doing. And it gets really difficult when you get long-term sobriety and you have to talk to somebody about compulsive behavior in another area of your life, because, you know, we get a little naive and we think that long-term sobriety is equal to mental health. And what long-term sobriety is equal to is recognized quicker when you're in a problem area and doing something about it. And that's the benefit of long-term sobriety. It doesn't wipe away the insanities that we're capable of having, that a newcomer is capable of having, that an old-timer is capable of having. And so I'm grateful for these rooms. You know, I still show up at meetings. I still volunteer for this. I still participate. Not because I think that I like it. It's because I think that I want to stay sober. And that's what these tools were given to me to do, to stay sober. So I'm very grateful to all the people in all the rooms. And I want to jump around a little bit now. When I in that six-year period when I was in and out, and I went to my sponsor, and I, you know, I'm a high school dropout, but I knew why I was not an alcoholic. I had medical reasons. I had scientific reasons. I had intellectual reasons. And I gave him all of those reasons why I'm not an alcoholic. And his response was, if you're not, I'd hate to have what you got. And I carried that resentment for a long time. And the other thing is the benefits of staying sober for a long time. At that period when I was being shuffled from New York to California as a child, my aunt, my father's sister, who took me in, I didn't understand what she had done. I was just going someplace because I was a bad boy and my parents had to get rid of me. And then I had to leave her because I was a bad boy and my parents taking me back. And But as the years went on, I understood that she kept me in the family, as dysfunctional as the family was at that time I was in. So when the family became a little more functional, I was still in. That was a wonderful. But the woman got up there in age, and when she was 97, I was given legal guardianship over her. She was in an old folks' home. Her daughter had died, and she passed away at 105. I was able to do something for her that she could do for me. Now, I did nothing that my brothers and sisters would not have done, but I was there, and I was only there because I was sober, and I was only sober because people taught me how to stay sober. And they accepted me in these meetings. And the idea that I can stand here and say, my name is Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic, and to have an acceptance, and to have people pay attention to me, allows me to identify myself as somebody worthwhile. And as an alcoholic, I'm not worthwhile. I know that to the core of me. And that always stays with me, but that I'm able to come here and be accepted, it gives lie to my core. And that's how I stay, that's how I've come to have a sense of gratitude and accept an understanding. You know, we're like, one more analogy, I don't know what it's called, but gem collectors, they put a bunch of stones in a machine, and the machine just keeps turning around and around and tumbling and what have you, and the stones get polished. And out of that, these nasty stones become some sort of a gem. And it's pretty much like what happens to us. We come into these rooms, and we are knocked about, and we are offended, and We are sensitive people. I'm more sensitive than you. But if we stay, we come out as gems. And it's only because we've worked up against, or we've been knocked up by other people in here. And we've learned the lessons of somebody else. Thank you.